or forever hold your peace. I know who you are, who you are. When you say my name, you don't say it like hers. Thank you.
Hace un ruido extraño. Sin importar lo que sea, no lo ignoras.
No es nada.
Es como tu salud mental. Si estás luchando y te sientes abrumado, es importante no ignorarlo y hacer algo al respecto. Puede ser tan simple como hablar con alguien o respirar profundo, porque una vez que le das prioridad a tu salud mental, descubrirás qué tan lejos puedes llegar. El Huntsman Mental Health Institute y el Ad Council tienen recursos para ti en conamortumente.org.
I finally got my first phone.
It is exciting. Let's learn a few things about online safety first.
We can secure our world. NASA.gov/secureourworld.
Innocent smile. All it hurts to see your innocent smile. All I'm breaking your innocent.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, you're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Today, we have a special episode with Professor David Shumway of the Literature Department at Carnegie Mellon University. He studies film. Thanks for coming on the show, Professor.
My pleasure.
Yeah, so you could tell us a little bit about yourself to get us started.
Well, I've been writing and studying about film since my days in graduate school at Indiana University in the 1970s. I've taught film at Carnegie Mellon since the mid-80s. I was involved in starting the film minor here and then in starting the film major. I've written about film in a number of different contexts, published in Cinema Journal. I have a book about the film director John Sayles. I have books about romance, where I write about romantic comedies and romance films like Casablanca and Gone with the Wind. So I have broad interest in cinema, especially American. But
so what attracted you to studying cinema in the first place?
Well, when I was in high school, I was interested in the arts, in especially in novels, which I regarded as a significant art form, but kind of realized at that point that it seemed as though the most interesting artists working at that moment were not novelists, but filmmakers. That was on the heels of the French New Wave and other important European directors who had really made a big splash here, and the beginning of the American auteur movement with people like Martin Scorsese and others making their first movies.
When would you say that change happened, when sort of the chief artists of a generation became the filmmakers?
Sometime in the 60s. I mean, there were great artists earlier, but they weren't generally recognized as such.
Mm-hmm. So I'll ask you a question you probably get a lot. What's your favorite movie to come out in 2024 so far?
Oh, in 2024?
Or any recent movie.
So what? Maybe my favorite movie in 2024 is Between the Temples, an independent film about a young cantor who is trying to figure out both his wife has recently died, so it's about his emotional difficulties, but also, of course, his relationship with the temple where he sings. It's the kind of movie that I like. It's small. It's about humans and their problems, and it's also funny. So, but you can tell that the title's a pun, Between the Temples being the brain, but also the place where he works.
Yeah, so I guess I'll put that on my Letterboxd watched list. Do you have a Letterboxd?
I don't.
Okay, you've heard of it though?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So I recently got one, and that has become my sort of chief place to get movie recommendations. Where would you recommend regular people find good movies to watch, especially ones that might not be getting a lot of TV coverage on commercials, maybe smaller independent movies? Where do you find these?
Well, the New York Times reviews virtually every movie that gets a commercial release in the United States, so that's a good source. Richard Brody of The New Yorker is a really interesting critic. I don't always agree with him. His views are very idiosyncratic, but he will point you in the direction of movies that you might not have paid attention to.
I'm curious about that interaction between film critique and film. Obviously, film affects film critique. Film critics are writing about movies, but has there ever really been some significant trends the other way? Have the work of film critics ever affected the way that people make movies?
Well, yes, in particularly some act very explicitly direct ways. The people who made the films that we make up the French New Wave almost to the last one of them began their careers as film critics for a journal in Paris called the Cahiers du Cinéma, which was edited by André Bazin, who is sometimes called the father of serious film criticism. And he nurtured these people who then went on to find ways to raise small amounts of money and make films that change the way we think about cinema, like Godard's Breathless and Truffaut's The 400 Blows. In the United States, Paul Schrader wrote an essay published in 1970 in a small magazine called Notes on Film Noir. Schrader, of course, goes on to write the screenplay for Taxi Driver and then to become a very estimable director himself. But it's interesting that Notes on Film Noir occurs 2 years before Chinatown appears and the beginning of the neo-noir revival. So almost certainly Schrader's essay influenced that trend in filmmaking.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that one of your particular interests is American cinema. What are some of the ways in that American cinema differs from other countries today? What are some things that we might not see out of Hollywood movies that other countries are doing?
Well, American cinema differs today from every other cinema. There is no other cinema in the world that is so focused on superhero movies, on franchises, on sequels. There's no other industry in the world that can support the budgets that Hollywood lavishes on those big production films. So we are an outlier. We're also still the dominant film industry in the world, though China is hot on our heels. But China does not produce anywhere near as many movies as we do, even to this day. They could if they wanted to. They have the largest film audience in the world, but they choose not to. Every other film, national film industry, remains, by American standards, sort of producing movies that look more like films did 30 or 40 years ago, which to me is all to the good. I much prefer those movies.
So on the topic of foreign films, they're getting popular. So Parasite recently won the first Oscar for Best Picture for a foreign movie. And you see a lot of people, especially younger people, consuming more anime and K-dramas from East Asia. There seems to be a trend in the United States to be able to consume more foreign media. What do you think has driven this trend, and do you see it having an impact on our domestic film industry?
Well, I think what's driven the trend is that people are hungry for different kinds of stories that these foreign films reflect. And I think films from Asia in particular are different enough from both European and American cinema that they really feel fresh to folks. We should keep in mind, though, that the audiences for these films, while significant in the sense that they bring in enough money, given the scale that these films are produced at, to be significant, it's a tiny fraction of the larger film audience here. I mean, most Americans are not seeing those films. It's a niche audience.
Mm-hmm. Pivoting towards something that we talked about in the class that I took from you, Intro to Film Studies, we discussed the auteur filmmaker quite a bit. How does one person guiding the vision of an entire film change the way that it's made versus having multiple people act as director, cinematographer, screenwriter?
Well, I'm not sure it likely changes the way it is made. All films, I'm sure there's the odd exception that proves the rule, but basically all films are highly collaborative projects. There are hundreds of people working even on a very small budget movie these days. So the person who's the guiding intelligence is going to be having to use that collaborative system. The difference between films that have a clear auteur and those that don't mainly have to do with the relationship of a particular film to others that an individual has made. Howard Hawks, one of the great directors from the classic era of Hollywood cinema, who managed, unlike most of his contemporaries, to never have a long-term studio contract. So he could float among studios and have more control over his own work, asserted that a great film was a film that had a few good scenes and you could tell who the devil made it. And so what he meant by that was, if you could recognize a personal signature in the movie, that really mattered to him. It was part of what made the film valuable. And that's the basic idea behind the auteur theory, that you should be able to tell that this particular intelligence is behind the movie.
When you think of great filmmakers, great auteur filmmakers, a lot of times the names that come to mind are older people, whether in the golden age of Hollywood or filmmakers who are kind of nearing the end of their career. Who are some of the younger filmmakers to look out for right now?
Wes Anderson, I would say, is the most interesting auteur working in Hollywood today. Which isn't to say I like all of his movies, but I think every one of his movies is interesting, and I can always tell who the devil made it.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Wes Anderson movies myself. Grand Budapest Hotel is one of my favorites.
Also one of mine.
Sort of shifting over to your job, how you teach students about film. I took your course a lot and remember enjoying it quite a bit, but it forced me to change the way that I watch movies. Watching a movie in a more analytical sense and being able to critique particular aspects definitely requires a sort of mindset change when you're watching a movie. What are some ways that you encourage students to approach that viewing experience with an eye for analysis and critique?
Well, by asking them to think about the way the film is made and structured, how it's edited. Are there long takes or lots of short ones? Is the dialogue intended to be realistic, or is it meant to be entertaining? Those two things are often opposed to each other. Are the settings evocative of an actual place, or are they more designed to evoke a kind of ideal world? There are so many levels in which you can analyze a film, which is why I think they are so fascinating to study. But by the way, I don't think people necessarily ought to go to the movies when they watch a film the first time and be primarily there to analyze it. I think it is important to let the film wash over you and to experience it as a piece of entertainment and as an emotional experience. Films are designed to evoke emotions in us. That's why watching movies more than once is really essential to be able to understand how they work. Because the second time you can begin to pay less attention to your emotions and think about the film more.
So a lot of times when we're talking about historical movies, we talk about the social or political context around them. However, when we talk about maybe more modern movies, it's sometimes a little harder to isolate that out because we're living in that social and political context. What are some of the social trends or political trends that you see affecting movies the most now, such that film critics in 50 years will look back and say, oh, they did this because of this trend?
Well, so clearly the changing gender roles and attitudes towards sexuality are a major change. In classic Hollywood, basically you have the heterosexual couple and the presumption that that couple will get married if the movie is to have a happy ending. And then there's a whole series of changes. I mean, in the late 60s and early 70s, you begin to get movies where people have relationships and they don't get married and it's not a tragedy. And part of this has to do with women beginning to be understood as not just being defined by their roles as wife and mother, but starting to have jobs outside the home that are more than just menial. And the Civil Rights Act of the 1960s and legal challenges to it in the early 70s are part of that context. But then, of course, attitudes towards homosexuality begin to change. Actually, they begin to change right around that same moment, but it's only been much more recently. It's been about 10 years, for example, since the Supreme Court ruled that same-sex marriage had to be legal across the country. That was a really significant event, and of course it has resulted in there being, say, romantic comedies about same-sex couples, which, I mean, there were a few before that, but not all that many. And of course we don't know, given the changes in the Supreme Court, whether same-sex marriage will continue to be legal. Many people fear that the current conservative court might overturn that ruling. But films, I think, will continue to reflect those changing attitudes. And presumably, we're going to see more gender diversity, more diversity of sexuality in movies as time goes on. One wonders how much the current political divisions in the country, which are about as bleak or as stark, stark is the better word, as they've ever been since the Civil War, whether that will be understood as a context for contemporary cinema. You see some of it reflected in a movie like Oppenheimer, which is partly about the kind of historical precursor moment, the McCarthy era, which affects the way in which Oppenheimer was treated, even though he was a national hero. Those are the two kind of recent political situations that come to mind.
Yeah, that makes sense. So for those of us in the audience and myself who have a pipe dream of becoming a filmmaker at some point in their life, how do people become filmmakers? We see the product, but a lot of times the business behind making movies is obscured. How does someone go from just being a regular person to being someone that gets to make movies?
Well, I'm probably not the best person to ask about this because I have no experience in the movie industry myself. One way, of course, is to go to film school. It was kind of a cliche that the generation of auteurs in the 70s were called the film school brats. Spike Lee, George Lucas, these people were the first generation of directors to have graduate degrees in filmmaking. But that's not the only way. There are people who get to make movies because they get other kinds of jobs in the industry and then find themselves behind the camera. But that involves a significant amount of luck. And of course, you may have noticed that many of the people who end up behind the camera start out in front of it. Actors who are popular, stars, have, of course, a better chance of making their own movies than the average person does. There are lots of jobs, of course, in filmmaking. If it requires hundreds of people to make a movie, that's a lot of jobs. A lot of students from Carnegie Mellon go out to California and take jobs at the lower levels of the industry, and some of them have the success of working their way up. I only know of one of our students who has actually directed a commercial Hollywood movie. There might be others I don't know about. And he did go to film school. But The industry has lots of positions. It's not so hard to get into the industry. It is much more difficult to actually get behind the camera and make your own commercial film. Now, if you just want to make a movie, that's easy these days. In fact, the cost of the equipment is so much lower today than it has ever been, partly because digital filmmaking is now the norm rather than the exception, and digital cameras are relatively easy to obtain. That's something that anybody can do, and that's, of course, one way that you can perhaps break into the industry. You make movies, you try to get people to look at them, and if they like what they see, they might get you a job. But the problem there is that because it's now so inexpensive to make movies, so many people are doing it. And so it's now, people now guess that literally 10,000 movies, feature-length movies are made every year, most of which are seen by no more than a few dozen people because they don't have any, there's no good way to distribute them. Mm-hmm. You can put them on YouTube, but how do you get people to watch them?
Yeah. On the topic of production budget, you see Hollywood movies with hundreds of millions of dollars in production budget and CGI everywhere. What motivates the Hollywood studios to spend that much money on CGI that didn't exist for all the good movies of the past?
Well, I think they believe it's what people want. And by that, I don't necessarily mean the majority of the population wants that, but the majority of people who go to movies with some regularity in theaters, that audience, Hollywood believes, wants to see grandiose special effects. It wants to see things people can't see in other ways, basically. I mean, you can't really watch you can't really see the power of these effects on a small screen. And people who like these movies know that, so they will pay to go to the theater to see them. And of course, Hollywood has, since the 1970s, been built around the idea of the blockbuster, which means, actually, it even goes back further than the 70s, but in the 50s, even, studios began to make most of their money from a few films that had the biggest box office. Prior to that, Hollywood made most of its money from having lots of films in theaters and making small profits on most of them. So that change begins in the 50s. And then in the 70s, it intensifies. And Hollywood makes a few movies, like The Godfather is usually pointed to as the first example, where a single film makes so much money that it now becomes worth it to try to figure out how can we make that movie, because that will keep us in business. But of course, the risk is that you can put all this money into such a film and it becomes a complete flop. There are, of course, famous examples like Heaven's Gate, where there's an enormous budget and literally no one goes to see the movie. So, and more commonly, films don't completely bomb in that way, but they don't make their production budget back. Every time a movie is released, there's a risk involved. And in fact, the movie, the system is now riskier for any given film because the odds of any particular film hitting are probably lower than they've ever been.
In terms of the movie industry, I've watched a few Bollywood movies. I'm Indian, and so a lot of times the most popular music in India at any given time is a song from a Bollywood movie. In contrast, in the United States, it seems like the two industries, film and music, are relatively more separate. You might get the occasional rapper starring in a movie, but the popular music isn't featured in films. Has that always been the case?
No, there was a time when movies had a great impact on the popularity of music in the 30s and 40s. there was a lot of crossover between the two industries. Bing Crosby, for example, started out as a radio star and went on to be one of Paramount's leading box office actors. The song White Christmas was first used in a Hollywood movie called Holiday Inn. It became so popular that it was the occasion for its own movie, White Christmas, with Bing Crosby as the star. So, yeah, there was a lot of crossover between the movies and music, and that lasts into the 60s. Elvis Presley was the leading male box office star in the early 1960s, and that was not because people thought he was a great actor.
Yeah. What do you think drove that trend of the two industries separating, or do you think it just happened naturally with people's preferences for music?
I think it has something to do with the changing character of movies, that music is not as important in the movies as it used to be. But also the way music is used is different. So prior to the late 60s, most movies had orchestral scores. If they used popular music, which musical films always did, but which dramatic films did relatively less often, that popular music was diegetic. It was performed in the context of the film's narrative. With The Graduate in 1967, you get the first instance of what is essentially a compiled score. The director took Simon and Garfunkel records that had all previously been released and used them as background music for much of the film. That helped Simon and Garfunkel. I mean, people bought their records because they heard it in the movie. But of course, it didn't introduce new music except for the one song that Simon and Garfunkel wrote, or Paul Simon wrote for the movie, Mrs. Robinson. It didn't introduce new music into the world. And the compiled score then becomes, not right away, but after a few years, increasingly common in Hollywood. But the compiled score almost always consists of older music. The movies are trading on music that people are familiar with, which helps to sell the movie. People want to come and hear the music they like, but it doesn't help sell new music.
So the trend kind of flipped in terms of which one was coming first. That makes sense. I think we're coming up near the end of our time today. It's been great having you on the show. To sign us off, tell us one movie that you think not enough people have seen that our audience should take a look at. Doesn't have to be recent.
Well, I will mention the film that I usually say when people ask me what my favorite movie is. It's The Big Sleep, directed by Howard Hawks, starring Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. It's based on a hard-boiled detective novel by Raymond Chandler. It is a film noir, though it is a unusual film noir because it has a more or less happy ending, and it involves a love story. It was a film that was